I'm going to read a bit from a novel I'm working on. The whole thing is written in the first person from the point of view of an elderly magician, as in a Paul Daniels type magician, not a Harry Potter type magician. And the bit I'm reading is actually a flashback to his earlier life in the early 1960s, and it's a chapter where that whole thing starts to blur between definitions of magicians. So I'll just get on with it. As I say, it's think of yourself in the early 60s here. It was back in 1963, just after my divorce from Susan, my first wife. Felix had got me a regular residency at Humboldt, a flash restaurant popular with the in crowd. This is the future for my act, I thought, to get in front of people with power and influence, and from there get onto the Gogglebox. A lot of old nitwits at the Magic Circle were still sniffy about television at that point, which perhaps spurred me on even more. Added to this was the knowledge that, whilst I was better than the vast majority of magicians out on the circuit, it wasn't always talent that won the day. One needed connections, and Humboldt was a good place to make them. After my gigs there, I would usually pop round the corner for a nightcap at the Garamond, a basement drinking club with a clientele of upper-class beatniks and Soho hoodlums with pretensions to bigger things. I'd sit alone at the bar, think about how the night had gone and how I could improve my act. It was here one night that I noticed a large man lurking in the shadows. "Hennessy!" the man bellowed. He stepped closer, one hand clasped to his head, as if to prevent his receding brown curls from flying away in amazement. "Please let me buy you a drink." The use of my real name, which I'd long discarded, marked this person out as someone from the past. It took me a few heartbeats to make the proper connection. Roger Beaumont? I'd not seen him since our school days in Scotland. He'd been a big, muscle-bound brute then, and now he looked even larger, although a look of sadistic arrogance had been replaced by one of bonhomie. Nevertheless, my initial reaction was to brace myself for a savage attack. After all, I'd been partly responsible for his nervous breakdown, age 17. Billy Swan and I had faked a terrifying seance which scared the young Beaumont at what few wits he had. It was all for greater cause. He'd been a vicious bully and needed taking down a peg or two. As it happened, we'd gone too far. Was he now going to clobber me? Apparently not. "How wonderful. It's been, what, 10 years? I'm glad I've run into you. I hear you're making your name as something of a magician these days." "It's true," I said, still a little heedful of those meaty fists of his. "In fact, I've seen your act. I was very impressed. It was at the Windmill. That can't be easy, keeping the crowd entertained in between the girls. But you had the meaty out of your hand, old boy." "No, no, they're a good audience there. Not just there for the TNA. A fine cabaret crowd. What you've got to watch for is the owner. He can suddenly take against you. He'll come up on the stage and physically push you off or set about you with a stick. I'm sure you could handle it. You're always that way at King's Charles." Beaumont then began to reminisce about our school days, although his version of events bore no resemblance to reality. He'd been a quiet, studious lad, the way he told it. He talked about how he'd got on with the other boys, and about the fantastic masters. "But," he said with a sad look in his eyes, "I feel I let the school down by going all non compos mentis. You know, Beaumont..." "No, no, Hennessy, it's not your fault. That little experiment of yours, I now know I shouldn't have got involved. I was emotionally fragile." "Oh." "I had it all bottled up. My father, he was not a good man. I dreaded the holidays." He was gazing at the wine rack behind the bar, as if here were the very receptacles that contained whatever it was that had bottled up a decade before. "I'm sure I would have gone over the edge eventually. It's my own fault. It's just that I looked up to you so much. You do have such remarkable powers." "That's what I've been saying to Mr. Dunwich." "Who's Mr. Dunwich?" Raymond suddenly brightened up. "He's a colleague of mine. I took him to see one of your shows. He was greatly impressed." Beaumont composed himself and told me about his life since I'd last seen him. He'd spent a year in a clinic in Switzerland. Highly unconventional, but very effective. Got me back to my old self. Because of his medical record, he'd dodged national service and had started working for a property developer, buying up old bomb sites and putting up office blocks. Very profitable, but more than that, I've met some very interesting people. It. Men with arresting points of view. Take Mr. Dunwich, for instance. I've learnt a lot from him about how things are run. You'd be surprised." "I certainly would be surprised if anything of worth came from the mouth of a property developer. They seem to be everywhere at that moment, putting up unlovely lumps of concrete. One can go to a decent party without inadvertently getting in a conversation with one of the swines. Mr. Dunwich is a member of a lodge, said Beaumont. They've got a wonderful place at Covent Garden. It's called the Paladino Club. And I've just been inducted as a member. Lots of influential people are involved. It's very exclusive. And they're so knowledgeable. They've taught me such a lot in such a small amount of time. About science and history and about how the world works. I suppose I missed out on all that at school. My problems, you see. We both took a mouthful of whiskey. The exciting thing is, though, after we went to see you perform, Mr. Dunwich asked if I could invite you along to the Paladino. They have a big event coming up. And as it turns out, a number of the senior members at the club are great followers of yours. What sort of event? I'm not sure. I think it's a charity dinner. Important people from all walks of life. They told me to say that Dr. Gregory Haxton had requested you personally. I'd never heard of the man, but didn't let on. A gig was a gig. I tapped Bowman's chest. You'll find a business card in your inside pocket. Ask them to give my agent a call. A couple of nights later, I was at the Paladino Club. I'd expected to be an oak-panelled cloud of pipe smoke and port vapours with thick crimson carpets and rows of 18th century oil paintings. I hadn't been wrong. Bowman met me at the entrance hall. He was accompanied by a tubby man with a magnificent white walrus moustache. An enamel badge with a flame insignia was pinned to the lapel of his torp suit. Good evening, Mr. Magenta, he said, shaking my hand. My name is Jerome Dunwich, Vice Chairman. I'm so very pleased to meet you. I've seen several of your, would you call them, performances? You could, Mr. Dunwich. It's just, the word seems a little cheap. Displays, demonstrations, manifestations. No matter. I'm not sure if young Beaumont here has told you. We're not usually excitable men, but I'm not ashamed to say we are in this instance really very thrilled to be meeting you. I was taken aback by the effusiveness of the man. It was at this point that my doubts began to nag me. You mustn't keep the other waiting, he said. Please follow me. I was led down some stairs into the cellar of the Paladino, and from there along a series of narrow corridors. The oak panelling gave way to a red velveteen wallpaper, the carpet to flagstones. As we walked, Mr. Dunwich told me a little about himself. He was also in the property business. In fact, he was something of a mentor to Beaumont. He was currently involved in organising the financing for an enormous office block at St. Giles, the tallest building in Britain, a new landmark for the London skyline. You may think that men of finance are dry types, devoid of a sense of wonder in the universe. And you'd be right about the vast majority, dead behind the eyes, that's what they are. Their brains closed to anything other than money. That's why this place is such an oasis, somewhere that those who have a thirst for enlightenment can assemble and converse with like-minded fellows, people who aren't afraid of the truth, particularly the truths that might shock or surprise the masses. The Paladino was just another place for the well-heeled snob about town, I realised. Somewhere to get drunk and smoke cigars and do business deals and rail against the world outside. Indeed, they might dress it up in antiquarian finery and add a smattering of esoteric claptrap, but it was clearly just a gentleman's club. Still, it might not do my career any harm if these bigwigs wanted me on the bill of some charity concert. We went down some staircases, past small passages and doors, Mr. Dunwich leading the way, Beaumont walking behind. Something of a hike, I remarked. The inner circle meeting the deepest level of building, said Dunwich. It's an addition. Inner circle? I thought I was coming to see your entertainments committee. Ha! He laughed, glancing back at Beaumont. Very droll. Only our top people for you, Magenta. Again, a little worried voice flickered to life. Perhaps Beaumont hadn't forgiven the incident at school after all. Perhaps this was all an elaborate prank, or worse. He could have grown up into a perfectly charming psychopath, hell-bent on elaborate revenge. We're quite some distance from the entrance, at least three floors beneath the ground by now. I might end up incarcerated in a dungeon for the rest of my life, or horribly tortured, or bludgeoned by some hard thugs. No one would ever see me again, all because of a schoolboy seance. But nevertheless, I followed Dunwich down the corridors. We eventually reached a set of double doors, which had distinctive triangular brass handles. I was struck by the similarity of the ashtrays that my ex-wife had so recently left behind. Mr. Beaumont will wait outside, said Dunwich. The room contained what I took to be the inner circle of the Paladino Club. Six men sat behind a table with an ornately embroidered cloth behind it. Behind them stood a row of wooden cabinets. The only other furniture in the room was a small table and chair. I assumed these were for me. The committee looked harmless enough, elderly and respectable, dressed in the same grey-brown suits as Dunwich, with the same enamel lapel pins. In my magenta suit, I felt like someone in one of those hand-painted Edwardian photos, a a blaze of unnatural colour in a sea of sepia. "Good evening, gentlemen," I said. "Good evening," said the one in the centre. He had thin white hair, and you could tell he was willowy even sitting down. "We're very pleased to see you. I'm the chairman of our brotherhood." We shook hands, then the rest of the men introduced themselves by role rather than name. Treasurer, secretary, keeper of the archives, monitor, and assessor. Dunwich, who by this time settled in at one end of the table, explained again that he was the vice chairman. As I glad-handed them, I put my doubts aside and my mind to work. The treasurer would be good for the disappearing fiver, and some other tricks, suggesting he was unable to look after money. Not to humiliate him, no, just a gentle gag, to show everyone that I knew how to entertain a crowd, that I wasn't just a collection of sharp moves. The monitor was a fidgety-looking chap, sat at the opposite end of Dunwich. I'd do the teleporting card with the two of them. The further the distance, the more impressive the effect. And the keeper of the archives had that sort of weak handshake and glassy-eyed look, which meant he'd be ripe for a spot of mentalism. I'd been working an excellent new mind-reading trick that I could try out. Once the introductions were over, I expected the chairman to say, "Let's see what you've got," or perhaps, if it was a more pompous bent, "You may begin." But he and the rest of the committee just looked at me, uncertain of what to say. I put it down to their nervousness. This had been palpable ever since I'd walked in. Perhaps I'd joined them after a particularly fractious meeting. Committees were the same the world over, from the humblest village hall, the most ancient seat of government. They're full of bickering ninnies with nothing better to do with their time. The world of magic was much the same. I coughed and said, "Would you like me to..." The chairman sprung to life. "No, no, no, there's no need to continue with the charade. You're amongst friends." "Charade? We're very familiar with the miracles you can perform," added Dunwich. "We know who you are." The secretary sat next to him, was adjusting his cufflinks. "But we understand that we need to prove ourselves to you." "Is that so?" I said, largely because I couldn't think of anything else. What miracles had I performed? I wondered what they'd do if I bolted for the door. The chairman walked over to one of the cabinets and brought a thick, leather-bound book to the table. "We've been observing you for some time, Magenta. We want to be absolutely certain before revealing ourselves. Our founder, Dr. Gregory Haxton, asked us to find you, and find you we have. Our next task is to ask you to listen to a recording of Dr. Haxton. These are the last words he's left for you." "I've never met a Dr. Gregory Haxton in my life," I said. "I think you really may have the wrong person." "We certainly haven't," said Dunwich.